The Alvaro Bay City having arrived, I'll call to order state and local government operations, reform, technology, and elections. First call on the agenda, Representative Simon, House File 512. What is your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 512 be recommended to pass and be referred to the general register.
All right. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Most people, if you were to ask them, don't think it's right that in the world's greatest democracy, the second-place vote-getter, can be President of the United States. And this isn't just about Bush versus Gore. I want to assure the committee and members about that. It's about what has happened in our past in this country and what almost happened a few years ago. Few people realized that John Kerry was a 60,000 vote shift away in one state, in Ohio, from having the exact same thing happen. Only he would have been elected president and would have lost the popular vote by 3.5 million votes. So I assure members that this is not about one election. It's about more than that. And let me tell you another story just so nobody doubts my own personal motives. In 1992, I was working for the Clinton-Gore campaign. I moved to Little Rock, Arkansas. And I remember sitting in a restaurant in Little Rock back when Clinton was in third place. Ross Perot was first, Bush was second, and Clinton was third. And there was a lot of speculation at the time about whether this was headed to the House of Representatives, about whether we might see the circumstance where no candidate got 270 electoral votes, in which case it would be thrown to the U.S. House. And the U.S. House at the time was solidly Democratic. This was before the sort of 1994 takeover by the Republican Party. And I remember being with obvious Clinton Gore partisans, and they were whooping it up, and they were cheering, and they were saying, "That's great. That means we're elected." And I was horrified by that. I said, "Wait a minute. Hold on. I'm here for the same reasons you are. I believe in this candidate. I believe in his issues. But I don't want to see the circumstance where the third-place finisher could be President of the United States. I think that's really, really corrosive to our democratic ideals and the ones that we so proudly talk about all over the world." So I want to assure members in terms of my own personal motivation that this is not somehow vengeance for Bush versus Gore. This is about the very serious problem that we have, where we have had and could very easily have in the future a President of the United States who was the second or even the third place vote getter, and I believe that that is wrong. So this bill, House File 512, would award Minnesota's electoral votes to the winner of the national popular vote. But it would only do that. It would only do that. It would only kick in if enough other states also agreed to do that. So we're not doing this alone. It would only happen if enough other states enacted the law to add up to 270 electoral votes, which is the majority needed, of course, to elect the President of the United States. So it's an interstate compact. It's nothing scary or new. We just did it last year, remember, with the Great Lakes Compact. It happens all the time. And interstate compacts are mentioned in and obviously sanctioned by the United States Constitution. So again, if enough states band together, Minnesota and others, and four have already done so, then this would take effect. And we could pull out at any time that we wanted to. So I think it's important to remember, members, this is not abolishing the Electoral College. It's, in fact, using the Electoral College, because few people remember that the Founding Fathers said that states may allocate their electoral votes on any basis that they wish. Now, 48 out of our 50 states have chosen to do it on a winner-take-all basis, but that's a state choice. The choice rests with us about how we want to allocate them. We could, if we chose, although it would be silly, allocate our electoral votes based on the tallest candidate or the one with the most letters in his or her name. We could do that. It would be dumb, but we could do that. So the Founding Fathers knew full well that it was up to the states to decide how they would allocate. And over the last couple hundred years, it just so happens that most have decided on a winner-take-all basis. But that, as I've already explained, has resulted in some real problems. And I take very seriously the idea, again, that the second or third place person, vote-getter, I don't care what party or what position, could be and has been President of the United States.
So, Representative Simon, we have a rather full agenda. Let us walk through the bill, because if we're going through the corrosiveness of the election process, you've given rather recent history, and I assume you could go back to elections that would have been in the 1800s and given us Supreme Court cases and even amendments to the Constitution that address this. But We're not here for that today, are we?
No, we're not, Mr. Chair. But
right,
please,
let's go to the bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, rather than walk through, I mean, the language is pretty straightforward, so I don't know.
And we're a straight shooting committee here.
Okay.
So,
in the interest of time, I just want to make the arguments I'd like to make.
All right.
You have in your material some background information. The polls show overwhelmingly that this is the kind of thing that both Minnesotans in particular, according to a January 2009 poll, and people around the country want. Four states, Illinois, New Jersey, Maryland, and Hawaii, Democratic and Republican governors, I might add, have signed this into law. And 22 other state legislative chambers so far, including several this year, have already passed this. I want to point out, too, just in terms of the history, and Mr. Chair, I just think this is part of the context, and so I hope you'll forgive me for one other thing. Remember that the Founding Fathers, you know, there's no mention of the winner-take-all system in the Constitution or in the notes of the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, and that's because they contemplated that the Electoral College would be made up of wise men who would get together and deliberate. Well, that hasn't happened. The Electoral College isn't a group of 538 people who actually get together and deliberate. That doesn't happen. I just want to, Mr. Chair, address one other sensitive issue here on the merit, which is this business of big states versus small states. And I know one of the fears here is that somehow small states will be disadvantaged, and that is unfounded by the numbers and by the evidence. Right now, under the current system, 90% of campaign activity as measured by dollars and candidate visits is in 15 states. 90% of it in 15 states. The current system hurts small states because 20 of the 25 smallest states are safe red or blue states. 20 out of the smallest 25 are solid red, solid blue. They don't get the attention, the visits, or the resources. Wyoming, Rhode Island, Idaho, Hawaii, Alaska, Delaware, etc. So with national popular vote, the candidates will campaign vigorously all over this country. And think about it. In Minnesota, we have a popular vote strategy. We don't have an electoral system where Hennepin County, if you win it, you get a quarter of all the sort of Minnesota electoral votes. We don't have that, nor do I think any of us who were redesigning the Minnesota Constitution from scratch would urge that, because it isn't fair. And so even though now, on a statewide level, we have sort of a popular vote system, no one claims that all the candidates spend all their time in Minneapolis or St. Paul. They go all over the state, as they should. They go to Thief River Falls and Zumbrota and Alexandria and all over our state. And that's because it's in their interest to do so. So it all comes back to fundamental fairness, members, in my mind. How can we say to a school kid in Afghanistan or Iraq or Germany or Australia, for that matter, that we believe in democracy and that we hold ourselves out as the paragon of democracy, which I think we should, because I think we are, but how can we do that and tolerate the system and explain to that school kid, well, you see, it works like this. It's not exactly everyone gets to vote for president. It's that sometimes it's complicated and it may be boring. The second or third place finisher could be president of the United States. So, members, I think 2009 this year is a good year to do this. The National Popular Vote folks from the National Organization urged me to bring this bill forward last year. I said no for two reasons. First, George W. Bush was still president, and I think this would have been seen while he was president as some sort of vengeance for the year 2000, which those of you who were here earlier, I've explained it certainly is not. And secondly, you can't do a bill like this in year four of the four-year presidential cycle. You just can't. It's too fraught with considerations about this or that candidate. It looks like someone's trying to game the system for their particular candidate. So my advice was, you got to do it in year one of the four-year presidential cycle. That's what we're doing. This is on the Senate floor right now over in the other body. And I urge your consideration and your support. Mr. Chair.
Representative Simon, to the bill.
Yes, to the bill.
Let's walk through this bill. If
sure.
It does what it says you have alluded to, then
sure.
Explain how the bill does it.
Sure. The bill is an interstate compact, just like the Great Lakes Compact that we did before. And because of that, I have to say it can't be amended, because interstate compacts, just like the Great Lakes Compact, as we discussed ad nauseum, I believe, on the floor last year or the year before, it's got to be exactly the same, and all the states have to agree on the same language. And this is just simply that language. I don't know any better way to put it, which is that Minnesota would allocate its electoral votes, its 10 electoral votes, based on the winner of the national popular vote. That's really it, Mr. Chair.
Representative Simon, I would prefer on this bill that you do walk us through the articles a little bit to explain it. If we're electing the President of the United States, which I also take very seriously, and this is going to allocate those electoral votes, I'd like you to explain how that's done.
Sure.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, for that, maybe I could turn it over to our testifier here, Mr. Pearson.
Welcome to the committee.
For the record, my name is Chris Pearson. I work for the National Popular Vote Organization. I'm a former member of the Vermont Legislature. I come from Burlington, Vermont. It's a delight to be here.
House were you in?
I was in the House.
Very good.
The People's House, sir. I'd be happy to walk you through quickly.
Would you please? Thank you.
Sure. So, as Representative Simon said, this is a contract between states. Article 1 simply states that any state may join, also is open to the District of Columbia. It does, Article 2 suggests that that states must allow people to vote for the president. That is not actually founded in the Constitution. It's one of the major changes to our election process that states made in our history. Article 3 is really the meat of it, and what this says is that Minnesota will award its 10 electors, not to the candidate gets the most votes in your own state, as you do today and as they do in 48 states, but to the candidate that gets the most votes in all 50 states. Article 4 is some other provisions that are meant to clarify and make sure everything is clear. The first part of that, seen here on line 2.25, starting on line 2.25 on page 2, suggests the trigger, and this is an important part, and this is one of the reasons why we've used the Interstate Compact methodology. There's a trigger that says this agreement does not take effect until enough other states have passed the same thing that cumulatively those states hold 270 electoral votes. That's a majority of the Electoral College. That's enough electors to send somebody to the White House.
So, Mr. Pearson, according to Representative Simon, that would be how many states?
Well, that depends, because states have a variety of
electors. Well, the fewest number would be what?
Technically, the fewest would be 11 states. The 11 largest states hold the majority of the Electoral College. But if you look at the four states that have passed our bill, only Illinois is among the 11 largest. So we believe it will take about 20 or 25 states to get there today. And we have, I should say, the four states, Hawaii, Illinois, New Jersey, and Maryland, hold 50 electoral votes, which is 19% of our goal, reaching 270. So Article 4 begins by detailing the trigger of it does not take effect until enough states are in the agreement. And when you've reached that point, that threshold of 270, the states that are part of this agreement will award their electors as a block of 270. That's enough to elect the president. It doesn't matter which states have passed the bill. You run a campaign, you add up the votes in all 50 states, and this is a very key point, in all 50 states plus the district, and the candidate with the most votes is going to win the Electoral College, is guaranteed to win the Electoral College, and they go to the White House. Article 5 is some definitions. Chief executive is referred to in the bill as the chief executive, the person that certifies the vote. In every state, it's not necessarily the governor. So we mean it also could include the mayor of the District of Columbia. The elector slate is the slate that belongs to the candidate. I mean, it's pretty straightforward, but we want to make sure this is all the I's are dotted and T's are crossed. Chief election official shall mean the state official. In many cases, that's the Secretary of State. In some cases, it's the governor. So this definition makes sure that we're not tripping ourselves up in that. A presidential elector is an elector for the president and vice president. Presidential elector certifying official is similar to the chief election official, but again, there are some states that make a distinction between the two. A presidential slate shall mean the slate of a president and vice president. And then there is a section in here that makes sure that should one of the slate members die between election day and the meeting of the electors, we're covered there. A state is a state or the district, and a statewide popular election is just what we think of as an election.
All right, Mr. Pearson, is there a scenario in the process where you join the compact, an individual gets the number of popular votes. Your state, however, has joined the compact and has voted for the other candidate and then would see its electoral votes go to the other individual. Is there a scenario where that would play out in this?
There absolutely is. I mean, the nature of this agreement is saying that the states that join the compact will give their electoral votes to the candidate that gets the most votes in the country. So let's suppose that Minnesota joins the compact. The compact's in effect, so we have a popular vote for president. Most voters in Minnesota choose the Democrat, let's say, if we look at history. But the Republican gets the most votes. Under that scenario, the Republican slate is going to win Minnesota. So you're not going to ask the Democrats to come to the Capitol and hold their nose and vote for the Republican. You're going to actually elect the Republican. Now, the country will understand fully that on election night we'll be watching returns and we'll understand that Minnesota, in this case, voted for a Democrat. But the mechanism of the way this works is that, in this case, the Republican slate would be elected. Now, when on a morning after an election, do you wake up to see watching the governor's race to see who won your county or to see who won the governor's race? Or after a presidential election, are you interested in who won your state or who won the White House? And if your candidate doesn't win the White House, is it much of a consolation that he or she won your state? I would maintain that voters are deeply interested in every vote being equal, every vote counting, and that the candidate with the most votes winning an election, not so worried of the technicality of the meeting in the middle of December.
Mr. Pearson, you might be, but the people of Minnesota might have a different view, considering how Minnesota voted. It would appear we might be trading one problem for another, but again, it's just an observation.
Sure. Chair, may I?
Representative Simon.
Again, I would say I believe if we were designing our state system again from scratch, I believe no one at this table would urge the same system for our state, whereby, let's say, Hennepin County would have a quarter of the state electoral votes. So, I just don't think we would do that.
That's the issue before us, Representative.
No, I know. I'm just making the argument. And so, Mr. Chair, I think what it comes down to for me, and poll show 70-some% is, do we want the scenario, again, as we averted by 60,000 votes in 2004, and as we had in the year 2000, so this is cross-party, where the second or even third-place person in the United States of America is elected president, and how can we go around the world touting democracy and explain to people why that's the case? So that's where I'm coming from. Others may disagree.
Further discussion. Representative Lannan, could you? Representative Lannan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Wondering, Representative Simon, if you could explain how this would play out if the election is very close, where there may in fact have to be recounts in multiple states, where you wouldn't have your 270. How would this play out? Would you delay the declaration of who actually wins until all of those recounts are settled?
Mr. Pearson, or
if I might, Mr. Chair. First of all, what you are all going through and the nation is watching your state uniquely in this year is not possible today under the setup of the Electoral College and the federal statutes that dictate the timing of the Electoral College. As we saw in 2000, the Supreme Court stepped in because there is a federal statute that says that official state results are due at the Hall of Archives in Washington, D.C. 6 days in advance of the meeting of the electors, which is in the middle of December. So the idea that a recount could go on and on and on, as we're seeing in this state and as is historically what we see in state election recounts, is just not the case today and is not the case under if we have national popular vote in effect. But it's important that we recognize a recount is far less likely under national popular vote. We've done some analysis of every statewide election that happened in this country since 1980. Everyone for governor, secretary of state, anyone that's elected on a statewide basis. And there are 7,000 elections that have happened since 1980. What you find is a recount rate of about 1 out of every 332 elections. And when we elect a president, we actually are holding 51 separate presidential elections, 50 states plus the District of Columbia. And so we have a far higher likelihood of triggering this rate of 1 out of 332 elections resulting in a recount. And that holds true over our history of presidential elections. When you have one big election out of with 120, 140 million voters, you are far, far less likely to see a recount. We estimate, the data suggests, that you'll have a recount one every 1,328 years if you have national popular vote.
I'm saying, Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, that really doesn't answer my question. If you need 200 states to account the 270 in order to have this take effect, what happens if you've got multiple states where you don't have, end up with 270? You don't have 270 electors that where it's clearly decided, because there needs to be a recount.
Well,
it seems to me that this this sort of says any and all recounts are irrelevant.
Yes. Mr. Chair, let's be clear that if we don't have states that are part of this agreement with a cumulative total of 270 electoral votes in place by, the law says, by July of an election year, then we don't use this mechanism for electing the president. So that trigger is not something that's loose. It's very firm. But once we have the states involved that we need for it to take effect, then it will dictate the upcoming election. At that point, you add up the votes in all 50 states. So we're not going to be treating the votes of, let's say, Minnesota, who is part of the agreement, differently from Oklahoma, who may not be, because we're just going to create a spreadsheet of 50 states plus the District of Columbia, and the candidate at the bottom of that spreadsheet with the most votes is going to be guaranteed to win the Electoral College. If we need recounts, if we have, let's say, a close national election, but no states are particularly close, then candidates will request recounts as they see fit. If we have one or two states that are particularly close, in 2000, Florida was painfully close, and we all sat on the edge of our seat while we watched that process unfold. Of course, the national election wasn't particularly close. Al Gore was ahead by 500,000 votes. So if we had national popular vote in place at that point, Florida would have been concerned about the exact total of its electoral votes, but the country wouldn't have been holding its breath waiting to see who the president was, because no recount in Florida was going to change the fact that Al Gore was about 500,000 votes in the lead. So that's a great example of where one particular close state, you know, they would have sorted that out for technical accuracy of exactly the right count, but it wouldn't have impacted the outcome. It's an example of how the current system actually creates more trouble for the potential of a recount than a national popular vote would.
Representative Lanning.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think this is tantamount to Minnesota saying we're going to give up our opportunity to really play a role in the presidential election, because whoever wins Minnesota is really irrelevant. If there are recounts around, that the whole recount process is irrelevant. It seems to me this is a creative way around the Constitution. And it may pass a constitutional test, but I think it's a creative way to change the intent of our founders of this country. And I cannot support it.
Right to my court.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. This is I enjoy these type of issues. They're nonpartisan, and we talk about elections. And it's a unique concept. I'm going to get a little parochial here as far as Minnesota. I'm looking at the chart here on battleground states, and I see like Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Florida, the big ones, they haven't really moved too far ahead on this. And I'm looking at, does Minnesota have more to lose than to gain? And what I mean by that is, as we've really become a battleground state probably in the last two or three elections for sure. In fact, this year on June 3rd, Barack Obama came to the Excel Center. He technically had wrapped up the nomination and said that. And, of course, this year the Republican National Convention was in Minnesota. And so I'm wondering, we get a lot of attention that we are a battleground state. And I see for the most part New Jersey, they're considered probably a battleground state. But don't battleground states that get a lot of attention, and Minnesota, has led the nation in voter turnout partly because of the attention. Don't we have more to lose than to gain
with a situation like this?
Representative Simon or Mr. Pearson, whoever wishes to.
Mr. Pearson? Well, it's important to note that Colorado just passed our bill through the House. There, no question, they are a key battleground state right now. Minnesota has been a battleground state. The battle seems to always go the same way. You know, what, first of all, voters don't distinguish. If you ask voters in Ohio or Florida or Minnesota, they all like this idea. They're not wed to this idea of a battleground state. What makes a state in play isn't the setup of the Electoral College, it's whether or not you have undecided voters. And I, as I understand, the demographics in this state are roughly a third undecided or unaffiliated, a third Republican, a third Democrat. So you have a sizable chunk of your population that needs to be courted, that could go either way. That means you will always be in play. You know, you are, again, 20 of the 25 smallest states are considered very safe. So we do have a two-tiered system. Whether or not Minnesota is going to maintain its battleground status is up for debate. But I think it's important to recognize that if every vote's equal, then every state will have some influence and be courted. Right now, you have, and to the previous point, the founders, nobody would convince me that the founders designed a system to lock two-thirds of the states out and take them for granted during a presidential election. We can talk a little bit more about that. But this notion that two-thirds of the money should go to six states, I think is a troubling one for many people who look at elections. And the fact is that our bill has been introduced in all of the battleground states you mentioned and has had some traction, less than other states, for sure.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add one thing to Representative Lanning. I really have to take issue with your statement about the Founding Fathers. That really isn't true. The Founding Fathers said states can allocate them on whatever basis possible. I gave some absurd results earlier that we could, if we wanted to, allocate them based on the tallest candidate. The Founding Fathers knew full well that we could choose any method whatsoever. If the Founding Fathers had meant winner-take-all, they could very well have said so. They could have said each state must allocate them based on who wins that piece of land, that state, and they did not do so. So the Founding Fathers consciously left open the possibility that we could choose whatever method we possibly wanted. And so I just take this issue with the historical fact. I don't think this is a transgression of what the Founding Fathers wanted. They gave the states freedom to allocate them on whatever basis we wanted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Simon, if that were really the case, why would have they even bothered with the Electoral College system?
Mr. Pearson, you want to respond?
Well, as we know, the Electoral College was debated throughout the convention or the method of electing the president. It wasn't exactly an overwhelming majority asking for an Electoral College. But we know that the founders feared centralized power, and they feared a president and a compliant Congress changing the rules to help themselves out. And as was the case with many of the checks and balances, they decentralized as much power as they could. In the reading of the history, they almost punted this question to the states. They couldn't quite figure it out. But they clearly did not settle on the winner-take-all rule that is what we think of as the Electoral College today. It was never mentioned in the Constitution, never mentioned in the Federalist Papers. And then in the very first election, of course, founders were active in state government. In the first election, it's important thing to realize, only three states used the winner-take-all method. Only five states actually let people vote. And so as that change happened, allowing more and more people to vote for presidential electors, that was an enormous change to the system. It didn't require a change to the Constitution. Founders were active, many of them, in state government. And again, the first election, only three states used the winner-take-all system. They changed the rules of awarding electors a lot at first. In some cases, they drew presidential elector districts. They used the congressional district system as is used today in Maine and Nebraska. And gradually, it evolved to the winner-take-all method that we see widespread today. But as late as the 1870s, Colorado, the legislature appointed electors. So it's taken decades for it to look like we have today. But it's very clear that the founders simply handed this question to the state. The Constitution is clear there. The Supreme Court has called this a plenary power belonging to the states. As recently as 2000, they reaffirmed that power. This was deliberately kept out of the hands of the federal government and handed to the states. I would argue since we have a system where every vote is not equal, we have a system where one out of 14 elections results in the election of the second place candidate, we have a system where five out of the last 12 elections were lucky not to have a second place candidate win, we have a system where two-thirds of the money spent and the candidate visits goes to six states routinely, we have a system where every vote is not equal and states are not well served by this, it's perfectly appropriate for states to stand up and embrace a state power and say, we need to fix this situation.
Representative Kalin, you're on my list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to return to to the stem of Representative Lanning's question, but I think a different argument. I think Mr. Pearson or Representative Simon, this may be more along your lines, Representative Simon, that if we have, let's say, 20 states in the compact, and the national popular vote is very close, within 0.25%, let's say, or let's say 10,000 votes. And over the course of time, and looking at the unofficial numbers as they become official, transcription errors, et cetera, you have all of a sudden a situation where we have an equal protection inequity, because would we not then ask all states or only the 20 states that are part of the compact to then recount their ballots? What happens in the 30 states where there is not a that are not part of the compact? And then does not Minnesota then cede our authority under the Constitution to count ballots under the processes that we choose? Who then determines whether you have been treated fairly?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I guess, first of all, your scenario of an election that is 10,000 votes spread it hasn't been seen. The closest election in 1960 is 118,000 votes. No recount's going to turn that number of votes. But under your scenario, if we have a close national election, you know, every state has ways to deal with recounts today. I mean, this is not an unimaginable horror. We count the votes once, we can do it again if we need to. Federal law today, I would argue, makes a fairly abbreviated window for that to happen because, like I said, the results need to be certified and in Washington 6 days in advance of the Electoral College meeting in mid-December. So I'm uncomfortable with that timeline. Let me be clear. But that exists today. We saw it in play in 2000. And federal law could change that, and we would be supportive of that. But there's no equal treatment issue here because every vote is equal, and every vote is counting equally across state lines. And so the states that are part of the compact, they could be part of the recount, and the states that aren't could also be part of the recount. Minnesota is never going to need to determine what's happening in Illinois necessarily. That's up for Illinois to do, just as it is today. Don't forget, the way a state handles these kinds of questions today can have enormous impact on the outcome of our election. Let's not pretend that Florida and the methodology that they used in 2000 didn't have a big impact for the whole nation. Or, the way fraudulent things happen in certain states can have an enormous impact today, whereas under one big election of 120 million votes is diminished. So I don't feel I've done a great job of answering your question because I'm not sure I totally understand your question, but there isn't a situation, we're not going to cook up a situation where Minnesota is in an uncomfortable position of needing to judge what's going on in Colorado or vice versa. Every state has to certify their own election results.
Representative Murrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, a follow-up to
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, who would order the recount in non-compact states, and would not close election, 118,000 votes out of 117 million, I think, were cast for the two winners this year. My numbers might be off, but 100 million votes. So it's actually fairly close. It's one out of 1,000. If the 30 non-participating states had chosen to select their electors themselves, on their own, the winner of their own state, then would we not then trigger a constitutional crisis or a serious constitutional question, because that recount would not happen until the electors meet or 6 days before the electors are scheduled to meet?
No, I don't think so. There's no distinction. Once we have a national popular vote, we're not going to distinguish between compacting states and non-compacting states, because you're just going to want the most votes everywhere. And in this scenario, I presume the candidate will ask for a recount in the jurisdictions they want to see recounted if they believe there's some votes to be gained. They have the right to do that. In some cases, you might have a scenario where it's not particularly close in Ohio, but the national total is close, and so the candidate has to choose, well, I want a recount in Ohio because I think something is strange there. If the total wasn't close in Ohio, it probably means that the candidate will have to pay for the recount. Candidates for president, that is not a significant problem for them. They would be happy to pay for the recount. But clearly under this scenario, the candidates have an interest in having it sorted out, and they have the right to ask for a recount.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pearson, your explanation of the original design of the Electoral College, I think, is a little flawed. I'd like to just at least touch base on that. My understanding is the Electoral College was originally created given the realities of the late 1700s. Little communication, no campaigning, the idea that folks wouldn't really get a chance to have much information on the candidates for presidency. So that the design was that there would be, though, a group of people within each state who would be informed and would have an opportunity to know about every candidate. They would get together and they would make the decision. Therefore, we elect the people to decide. The idea was that they would be an enlarged, informed filter, if you will, for the electorate of every state. That reality, though, has changed, given 21st century communication, given the fact of the modern campaign and the like. In fact, that's also why the Senate was to be elected by the state Senate or state legislature, again, because of communication, campaign practices, and the like. So I would argue, actually, that the status quo has changed from the 1787-1788 situation to 2009, and then calls into question, then why do you continue to have the Electoral College when the principles upon which the Electoral College is based no longer exist? I do wonder, though, why this shouldn't proceed through a constitutional amendment at the federal level. That seems to me to be the sounder way, although I do say I'm an author of the bill. I'm an author of the bill because I believe in the concept of one person, one vote. The historian in me, though, is keen to get rid of something like this, but maybe I would say the voter in me says this is the better way to go.
I'm not sure we're disagreeing. I agree with your reading of the history. It's very clear that the founders didn't really envision necessarily a role or certainly a commanding role of voters in the process. They did imagine the electors to be a deliberative body of elders to sort of figure out what is best for their state. They also envisioned that the Electoral College would not produce a majority winner and that Congress, in fact, would elect the president often. They thought that would be commonplace. They also didn't envision political parties. By the first competitive presidential election, we had political parties, and electors were not a deliberative body at all. They were a rubber stamp for the will of the voters. They were party faithfuls, elected by parties, and they rubber stamped the choice of the people in their state. Right now, the Electoral College is a rubber stamp in each state. We're changing it to a rubber stamp for the whole country. And the history of making these improvements, you referenced direct election of senators. That's something that started through state action. And states ran advisory elections. And whoever won the advisory election was then appointed by the legislature to serve in the U.S. Senate. States were the body to grant, as I said earlier, the right of citizens to vote for a presidential elector. States removed the property requirement as an impediment to voting. States granted women the right to vote. They were the first body to do that. I hope we would all agree that that was an important advance in our process, and I would take issue with anyone who suggests that was not proper for states to do that. And then states did allow for a method of direct election of U.S. senators. All of this national popularity is very, very in keeping with the history of improving elections in our country. And at the end of the day, many people believe that every vote should be equal, and when you get the most votes, you should win an election, and that's what national popular vote delivers.
All right. Anyone else wish to testify on the bill? One more individual?
Yes.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
I will keep it brief. My name is Mike Dean. I'm the Executive Director of Common Cause Minnesota.
Could you just repeat your last name?
Dean, D-E-A-N.
Okay. Thank you.
Common Cause Minnesota is here to support House File 512, which would create agreement among states to elect the national popular vote. We believe that the current system of electing the president is anti-democratic. The winner-take-all also enforces candidates to focus on so-called swing or battleground states. Candidates then have no reason to poll, visit, advertise, organize, or pay attention to the concerns of states that are safely ahead or hopelessly behind. Functionally, this means that voters in two-thirds of the states are ignored in presidential elections. In 2004, this was concentrated in two-thirds of the money was concentrated into five states and 80% in nine states. While Minnesota has been not always ignored by presidential candidates, the current system has really favored the big swing states of Ohio, Florida, and Pennsylvania. Besides focusing the campaigns on only a handful of states, the current system gives unequal weight to voters living in different states. A Wyoming voter is about four times as much impact on selecting the state electors as California does. We also believe that in the concept of one person, one vote, but the electoral system completely disregards that idea. The 2008 election was historic, not because of what happened on Election Day. History was made during the primary season when people from both parties turned out in mass because their votes were actually going to matter. For the first time, people in very red states and very blue states saw presidential candidates in their state talking about their issues. This demonstrated what's possible under a national popular vote plan. I urge you to support the National Popular Vote Compact as a better and more democratic way to choose our president. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions for this testify? Seeing none. Representative Simon, I don't think that anyone else is going to testify to your motion.
Mr. Chair and members, thanks for your time on this. I renew my motion that House File 512 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register.
All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
Division. All those in favor, please raise your hand. Opposed. It is 8-8. Motion does not prevail.
Thank you, members.
Next bill on the agenda, Representative Flowick, House File 222. She is gone. Next one, House File 1373, Gardner.
Good morning, Mr. Sheriff. Someone could move.
Representative Gardner, I will move House File 1373 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. We believe that's where it's going to have to go.
Yes.
Okay, Representative Gardner, to your bill.
Mr. Chair, House File 1373 is a bill that's designed to break down a lot of the funding silos that we have as it relates to transit, which is not mass transit and which is not medical transportation. We had long discussions in health policy, some of you are on there, about ambulances and ATS and STS. This is not what this bill is about. We have in the state lots of different transit assets. They include everything from school buses to van fleets that are used by nonprofits and other agencies that serve people with disabilities. I have 34 nuns in my district who take metro mobility exclusively. So we're talking about buses that don't use a fixed route and that are not used specifically for medical purposes. The problem is that there are so many different funding sources to pay for this type of transit that the left hand and the right hand don't really know what each other are doing. And so we have funding silos where education dollars from the federal and state government are paying for accessible buses for school districts. We have transit money paying for Metro Mobility buses. We have human services dollars paying for people.
Listen, Doug, I'm going to interrupt you for a second.
Certainly.
There's an amendment here, and it's a delete-all, but it looks like it's a clarifying delete-all. It's a technical one. Do we need to put that on?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shepard helped me just to make it
all right.
Clearer.
Now, I'm going to move the BE1 amendment, and then, Mr. Shepard, can you tell us what this amendment does?
Mr. Chair and members, I had suggested this to Representative Gardner and to Mr. Malander, and I talked about this because the bill had a somewhat unusual procedural posture. It was amended in a division of the Finance Committee, and then it was recalled from Finance by floor motion without a committee report ever having been prepared for it. And so I thought it would be best to express the work that was done in division as a delete everything amendment to the original bill after it got sent to this committee. So it's really almost identical to the bill that came out of the Finance Division. I thought this is a procedural matter. I talked with Chief Clerk Mathewitz, and we thought this would be the best way to handle this.
All right. Members, any questions to the amendment? All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So, Representative Gardner, we've got the bill in the form. I think you need it.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your packet, you should have a handout which just has an executive summary from NCSL. They actually did a whole report on coordinated human services transportation, and one of the things that they highlight, and I put stars by them, is that some of the things that we are doing probably are not sufficient. There was an executive order by the governor several years ago to create the Interagency Committee on Transit Coordination, which is meeting and has identified some ideas that will help improve service, increase efficiency, and reduce costs. But the Senate author and I felt that we needed to move this up to a council level rather than have it rely on an executive order. One of the start items here shows that in states without legislation that are dependent on an executive order will want to consider whether this approach adequately addresses coordination concerns. And then also talked about the stove piping or the funding silos there. The other problem we're trying to solve is the huge overlapping of service. I also have a GAO report page that's stapled to that handout, which shows just an example from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. It was a federal study, so they just, I don't know why they picked out Sioux Falls, but it shows the huge amount of overlapping routes and providers serving people in roughly the same area. And having worked in an industry, recycling for 10 years, which relies on efficient routing of materials from one place to the other, it just struck me as this is an area where we are ripe for reform, where there's everything from dispatching and brokering and efficient software routing to actually help people coordinate some of these services so we can save money. Does create a council, and that's why the bill's here.
Representative Merle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gardner, MnDOT reports that it's planning on completing a state transit plan that addresses some of these issues by the end of the calendar year, and I'm looking at the appointment date on line 3.11 of the DE1 of appointment by August 1st. My understanding is MnDOT's going to be well into the state transit planning process, including some of the groups that are mentioned in this list. I'm just wondering how this legislation would interact with that state transit planning process.
Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morrow, actually wasn't aware of that, but folks at MnDOT have been part of the planning process for this bill, and I don't know if it's an issue of whether they're in different little compartments or what, but we have been in touch with MnDOT, and I certainly can follow up on that and see if that's the right day for the right format.
Further questions to the bill as amended? Representative Gutwall? Okay. Representative Gutwall.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gardner, I appreciate the intent of the bill. I was just jotting down here from my own experiences in local government. I mean, we've got MnDOT, we've got a Met Council, we've got Metropolitan Transit Commissions involved in these activities, area planning organizations, planning commissions, city and township councils. Department of Human Services would have some role in some elements of this. And I understand the desire to kind of coordinate and consolidate and all of those sorts of things, but as I consider what each of these are doing, they're each playing their role in doing transportation planning and funding. I think there's certainly something to recommend the fact that we've got local units of government involved in local community transportation planning, whether it's bike trails and walk paths or streets and bridges. I'm just not quite seeing the need for another layer of bureaucracy to do transportation planning. It seems like we've got plenty already.
Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, I appreciate the comment. I worked in the nonprofit sector for 15 years, and so I made my living in cutting through layers, and so I certainly appreciate the comment. However, we're just seeing that things aren't working in a way that's coordinated, and every local provider I've talked to have said, yeah, they're actually looking for some help here. There are 62 different federal programs that pay for these types of services. I don't know if they all apply in Minnesota, but even if a fraction of them are playing the role here, I'd like to see if we can figure out how we can bank some savings. I can't actually find in the budget now, in the Health and Human Services budget or anywhere else, line items for this type of service, because it's enmeshed in so many other different things, in medical assistance and other things. The only thing that is itemized is on the non-emergency medical transportation, which was a real hot issue yesterday in health policy, and that's covered by this bill. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But I certainly would like to have a way for people to be talking to each other. It doesn't mean they have to give up service or authority necessarily, but it does mean that people could get more for less, I hope. And I have my 34 nuns in North Oaks who wait 2 hours for a bus, and that's considered on time, and that's the problem I'm trying to solve.
Right. Members, we've got a number of bills on the agenda, and while we have most of the members here, we will be starting at 8 o'clock on Tuesday, and there'll be an email sent out just so everyone knows. Representative Member.
Thank you. Representative Gardner, this bill is not going to solve your constituents in North Oaks waiting for a bus for 2 hours. It would seem that you should go to the Transit Authority and work with them. I listened to you, and I wasn't going to jump in, but this is absolutely the wrong way to go. The right idea, but the wrong way to go. You've got every one of these organizations in place that you should be working to reform and get them to work together, as opposed to creating another paid board in a time where we can't afford to keep creating more do-work boards that don't really have anything to do except study and collect per diem. We've got the Institute for Transportation Studies. We've got all kinds of resources in this state, and it would seem that if you're so motivated, and there are several people motivated the same way you are, why aren't we working to reform the current organizations that we have, try to skinny down some of those and get them to work together, as opposed to creating another bureaucratic board that will self-perpetuate and collect per diem? This just doesn't make any sense to me.
Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I appreciate the comment. We did have language in here regarding compensation and per diem, which pretty much puts it in line with other entities, so that if you're a state employee, for example, it's all part of your regular job, so I'm not quite sure who might be receiving per diem in there. I will say, though, if for some reason we can't fund this, I would do exactly what you just mentioned during the interim. There actually is this Interagency Committee on Transportation Coordination that I would say is sort of at the lower levels of government that isn't really attracting attention by the people who actually make decisions to get that coordination done. I think the legislature has a leadership role to play here in helping push this to actually happening.
Anyone else wish to testify on this bill? Seeing no other testimony, no other discussion, I'll renew my motion that House File 1373, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay?
No.
Motion prevails. Bill's passed.
Thank you, Mr.
Gardner. Representative Schulte is, unless Representative Slawick has returned. Has she returned? She hasn't returned. She's still downstairs. All right. Representative Hilke, 1133. I'm sorry, 1137. Representative Hilke, the motion to your bill, I believe, is finance. So if you want to make that motion.
Mr. Chair, I was thinking that this bill could just go to the General Register as Finance asked to see the bill.
I'm told, Representative Helge, that this bill went to Finance in the Senate, and that we anticipate a similar request here. I don't have any other options, actually.
Very well, Mr. Chair, then I would move that House File 1137 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance.
All right. Representative Helge, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an appropriate bill to be considering this morning. considering the discussion has already taken place. But what this bill does is a couple of different things related to the recount provisions that we have currently in law. Section 1 deals with how a defective ballot would be defined, and Section 2 lowers the threshold, or I guess raises the threshold, depending on how you want to look at that, for an automatic recount from one half of 1% to 1/4 of 1%. The rest of Section 2, those definitions that merely clarify who is the filing officer. Another thing that is included in the bill in these sections is that instead of now a situation in which if the threshold is met, the recount is automatically triggered, this bill would provide that the recount is only conducted on the request of the candidate beating a threshold.
Representative Greeley, there's an amendment.
Chair, I think that's pretty much the bill.
Is this your amendment, the A1 amendment?
It is. It's the author's amendment.
Do we need to put that
I
on?
Would move the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hildy, do you want to explain the amendment, technical or substantive, or both?
I think, Mr. Chair, it is largely technical. It says on line 12 in page 1, it simply clarifies that written outside, it changes that to written completely outside. On line 15, it changes the term automatic to required recount. I think the language on page 2, line 16, is merely clarifying language. I think it was a little difficult to read previously. And the language on page 4.
Clarifies
that language as well.
We're on the amendment right now, and I want to get the amendment out of the way. If you have a question on the amendment, we'll go to you, but if not, we'll get the amendment finished.
It's not clear.
All right. Any further discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Cox.
Mr. Chairman, my question has to do with the period of time for the filing of the request. What is that? The sentence, is that always, what is that number?
Right, Sam, I'm going to also, we have Ms. Frazier here, yes. So she hasn't introduced herself, identified herself for the committee, but she may be able to answer that question too. So welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Frazier with the Office of the Secretary of State. Representative Khan, on lines 2.4 to 2.6, it says that the request must be received during the time for notice of contest.
Yes, that was
Representative Penn?
That was my question. What was that talk? And Mr. Chairman, if I can just make one...
Representative Penn.
One explanation. I was the person who first suggested the concept of the automatic recount, and maybe that was just in more innocent days when there weren't as many people following elections. But it occurred because in the 1972 election, a candidate was defeated in St. Louis Park, I think, by two votes. And because of some misinformation on the filing time, you know, sloppy work on someone's part, I don't know if it was on his part or on the people, he filed his request for whatever you had to do then, the suit for a recount, which was probably a little bit more complicated, you know, one day too late, something like counting weekends or not doing it. And it just seemed to me at that time that any election that was within two votes should just be automatically recounted. And that was when we put the first one in. So the question is, you know, I guess, you know, now there are too many parties and various people concerned. I guess that would never, that kind of thing would never happen again with the bigger interest of state parties in it. But, you know, that's the incident that still sits in my mind. So that's why I'm not so anxious to get rid of the order. But it might have been the difference between having to file a suit and make a request. So it might be.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tom, the rationale for requiring candidates to actually request the recount stems from the primary statewide recount that we did of a judicial seat, where the candidate would have had to have waived the recount. And I called the candidate to let her know that she could waive the recount. And she said, oh, was it that close? Oh, there's going to be a recount. She didn't attend any of the recount sessions, but yet we had to count 300,000 ballots. And it just seems like we want to be sure candidates are at least interested before we spend the time and energy and money recounting the ballots.
Representative.
Chairman, I guess in these more pressured days, the scenario I observed would not occur again. So.
Never say never. Ms. Frazier, I've got a question on page 4, our Representative Hilty. On subdivision 2 under section 5, there's a penalty here. Would this need to go to civil law? And it would appear to be a new penalty.
Mr. Chair, that's a good point. And I'm not sure that the penalty is necessarily a vital part of this bill, but I would ask Ms. Frazier to address that question.
Well, you would either go to public safety or civil. I'm not sure which of the two, but it would go to one of them. Public safety, and I'm told. Ms. Frazier? Do you want to address why there's a penalty here and why it shouldn't go to public safety?
Mr. Chair, there's a penalty here to ensure that there's actually some sort of teeth in the prohibition on obstructing or interfering with a recount. And whether or not it has to go to another committee is up to the rules of the House.
Well, the issue's been raised. Representative Hilty, you could withdraw your motion and then have a new motion to send it to public safety just to ensure that it doesn't have to make another detour once something's been identified. Usually, it wants to go.
Mr. Chair, I think maybe the simpler solution to that problem would just be to delete that provision.
Okay, then if this is an amendment, can you tell me exactly what you're deleting now?
It would be to delete the sentence on beginning on line 4.13 after the period, getting any candidate and extending through line 4.15.
I'm going to have Mr. Gehring make sure that's in writing and then that it works. And if we delete that, we still have a coherent subdivision, too. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, I think that does work. Then also in line 4.11, you probably want to delete violation semicolon penalty.
All right. And then you're going to give that in writing to Mrs. Anderson, so we have it in the minutes in writing. All right, so that's the amendment now that is before us to the amendment, Representative Ellis.
The amendment, Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty or Ms. Fraser. What I'm concerned about is that, assuming that a similar proposal is traveling through the Senate, I thought that's what we had said when it started, that it went to finance the Senate. And I'm assuming that there's a similar provision, including the penalty. What I'm concerned with is you're going to withdraw the penalty here so this can advance the Finance Committee and then hopefully the floor. At some point, when the two bills get matched up, then did the House not have an opportunity to properly vet the penalty? Will it come back at some point with a penalty on it? In other words, are we just doing this for expediency today to avoid having to do the work that we're supposed to do, or can you assure me that it'll never come back with a penalty on it? Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I'll make the commitment to ask the Senate author to strike that sentence from the Senate bill as well.
All right. Representative Walton, we're on the amendment.
Yeah, I'll wait.
All right. Any further discussion to the amendment? All right. All those in favor of the Hilty Amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Gutwald, now to the bill's amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hilty, I'm not quite understanding, and perhaps your testifier can help with this as well, why we need to reduce the threshold for an automatic recount. I would think Minnesotans would have had enough of recounts, frankly, lately, and why we would create a lower threshold and trigger more recounts at a lower threshold makes no sense to me. This is reducing the threshold from a half to a quarter, correct?
Ms. Frazier.
Representative Gottwald, the effect would be to trigger fewer recounts. We're saying that in order for a recount to be triggered, there has to be a smaller number of votes. A quarter of a percent is smaller than a half a percent. So it's actually intended to trigger fewer required recounts, not more. And I could say about that, since I have been involved with the recount issue for some time, that when this was first proposed, I found it somewhat disquieting, but actually, a provision that I was responsible for passage of in the last session, I think, kind of softens the impact of this. We do now have in place the partial discretionary recount, so that if a candidate came close to the quarter percent threshold but didn't quite meet it, he or she would have the opportunity to ask for a partial recount of up to three selected precincts, so that that could go a long way to satisfying the question of whether a further recount would be requested, and in fact the result of that could actually trigger a recount.
Representative Gutwald, I've got two more people.
Yeah, real quickly, Mr. Chair. Under Section 5, line 4.23, beginning at line 4.23, it says individuals acting as candidate representatives in a recount must be residents of Minnesota. What is the purpose of that?
Representative Hilty or Ms. Fraser? Ms. Fraser?
Well,
or Representative Hilty?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Fraser may want to add to this, but I think that part of the experience that we've had with representatives of candidates coming from out of state is that they're not familiar with Minnesota law or sort of Minnesota culture, and I think most of the difficulty that we have experienced with challengers and our observers in polling places in Minnesota has been from people that fall into that category of coming from someplace else where there's a different culture and a different legal system regarding elections, and they tend to be very disruptive because of that.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilty, just a clarification, and I like your language on the losing candidate requesting the recount, but if that's the case, do we really have automatic recounts anymore if you have to request the recount?
Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the author's amendment actually changed the term on line 1.15 from automatic to required. Would not, as you point out, be automatic.
Right. Representative Lane.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the way I understand this language on page 3, 311 and beyond, that we have a different threshold for the House and the Senate. That most Senate seats probably would exceed the 25,000. Most House would probably be, if not all, under 25,000. Am I understanding that correctly? And then the follow-up question would be, where did the 25,000 come from? How was it determined that that should be the threshold?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, that's not accurate. Section 4 relates to local offices. House and Senate candidates are covered in the second section of the bill, which deals with all state and federal offices. So Section 4 only relates to county, municipal, and school district offices. And the 25,000 number was come up with in conversations with local election officials. And since that seemed fairly equivalent to the number of votes that might be in a House race. And so since this standard was going to be in place for House races, we wanted a fairly equivalent standard for larger local races, and that seems like a cutoff that made sense.
Thank you. All right. Any further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, Representative Hilty, to your motion.
Mr. Chair, I would renew my motion that House File 1137 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance.
All right, as amended.
As amended.
All right. Thank you. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails. Is Representative Slawick, is she back? If she is, where is she? There she is. All right. All right, Representative Frolic, this was a bill we had tackled once before, and we had simply laid it over. We had not laid it on the table, we just laid it over. What's being passed out to you now, members, is Mr. Gehring has a... I'm going to let him explain. This is apparently the A2 amendment to House File 222, so I will move the bill, House File 222, be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. And then I'll move the A2 amendment, which is coming at you now, and I'm going to have Mr. Gehring explain. No, isn't this it? Yeah, Mr. Gehring is going to explain you.
All right. Sure, I think
Mr. Gehring is going to explain this whole thing. And I think that's the safest thing to do.
I agree.
I think what's being handed out is an additional A5 amendment that hasn't been adopted by committee. And then the 8.5 by 11 sheet that's coming out is actually by 11 sheet that's coming out is actually sort of a handwritten unofficial sort of engrossment of what the committee did during the last hearing. The handwritten text is the text of the A2 amendment as it was adopted during the last hearing, and then the language that's crossed out with the X reflects the oral amendment that Representative Kalin offered that failed in committee last time. So this reflects with the handwritten text what the bill looks like right now as amended by the committee.
And then, Mr. Gehring, do we need to put the A5 amendment on, or Representative Slawick, does that have to go on?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we actually have A3, 4, and 5.
A 3, 4, and
but,
5.
But 5 is directly to the A2. It's an amending the A2.
All right. Why don't you explain the A5? I'll move it.
Mr. Chair, the A5 amendment appears to be amending the A2 amendment, which was already adopted by committee. So if you were using the shorter piece of paper, you'd see the new language being added by the A5 amendment fitting in with the handwritten language after state or federal law.
Mr. Gang, why do we need this amendment?
I'm sure I'd defer to Representative Slavik on that.
Representative Slavik.
Mr. Chair and members, it will match the Senate language, and it also would allow local candidates to be able to come in.
All right. The amendment's been moved. Further discussion to the amendment. This is the A5. Representative Popper.
I just have a question. Which line? Am I reading it wrong? Page 1, line 4. Different line.
Mr. Gang.
Mr. Chair, the page and line references are to what was technically written on the A2 amendment, which I don't know if it's in the packets or not. But it's,
well,
you can see the you can see the text. It's handwritten on the 8.5 by 11 sheet that was passed out. If you don't have the A2 amendment in front of you,
I believe, Mr. Gehring. No, we've had a great deal of time to put this in the shape we need to put it in, and here we are again with what is an extremely confusing.
Mr. Chair, I believe the A2 amendment is now being passed out. So,
all right.
Using the A5, the page and line references from the A5 amendment, you can find where it fits in the A2. The A2 amendment has already been adopted by. So you'd be amending an amendment that has been adopted already.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Emmer.
I understand that the chair and the committee are trying to be flexible, but this has been out there for several weeks, and it looks like we're making sausage.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I'm really at a loss here as to why we have three pieces of paper in my hand trying to figure out what we're doing after this much time. It's simple. There are reasons for delete everything, and we've tried to explain that a delete everything that clarifies is much better than what we have before us now. So I'm going to lay this thing over one more time.
Mr. Chair.
And if I see it again, I'm going to see it in a clear, clarified way. Representative Flowers.
Sure. The staff may be aware that this language was taken up in the Senate yesterday. Mr. Turner, if one is a technical amendment, which is A4, the other was the agreed-upon Nelson Amendment, which is A3, if I could pull A5 and still move forward.
Even that explanation is difficult to follow. At this point, I'm going to lay it over one more time. You're going to get one more shot Tuesday, and it's going to be in proper form and shape so we can understand what we're doing. Thank you, Mr. Representative Long. Representative Winkler is up next. Representative Winkler, House File 1882, and I believe we've been told this is going to go to rules. So, to your motion.
Mr. Chair, I move House File 1882 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Rules and the Legislative Administration.
All right.
And, Mr. Chair, there is an amendment that Mr. Shepard prepared, the A2, and I would like to move that to put the bill in shape.
All right. Why don't you just explain what... Are you moving the A2? There's an A1 here, too. Do you need... I'm not doing it. All right, to the A2.
Mr. Chair, this just adds one extra provision of the definition of a legislative day to include... in addition to first, second, or third reading, a date on which either House votes to override a governor's veto. And I'll explain why after I go through the bill.
All right. All those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Winkler, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Your bill is amended.
In the 1970s, the voters approved a change to the Constitution that moved us from a biennial legislative session to annual sessions. At the time, before this amendment, we also were limited to a total of 120 legislative days, so that the total amount of time that the legislature sat in session every 2 years was 120 days. In the constitutional amendment, they didn't remove the 120 days provision. Instead, they said that the definition of legislative day could be defined in law.
Currently, the definition of legislative day means when the House or Senate meets in session. But it doesn't serve any practical purpose. The definition that we have right now of legislative day doesn't limit the amount of time that the legislature spends in session. That's already limited by the Constitution, by the dates that we may meet. It simply changes how many days that we can use to process bills on motions or other kinds of action versus days that we can do actions that are prescribed in the Constitution. So the bill changes the definition of legislative day from a day in which we meet in session to a day in which we meet and give a bill the first, second, or third reading or vote to override a gubernatorial veto. And the reason why those days are chosen is that in Article 3 of the Constitution, Section 19, it specifies that each bill has to be reported on three different days in each House. So in other words, that the Constitution prescribes that a bill has to receive a first, second, or third reading. And in Section 23 of Article 3, the Constitution provides that the House and Senate may override a governor's veto. So we're taking the prescribed action for moving legislation as defined in the Constitution and defining that as a legislative day. The reason for doing this is simply that right now we have a system of 120 legislative days that serves no purpose. The only purpose that it serves, or the only result that it has, is that it creates an opportunity for mistake, and it's an inconvenience when it comes time, as we approach deadlines, for example, to move bills between committees. Those sessions when we meet are merely for the purpose of processing bills according to our rules, and there's nothing in the Constitution that would suggest that when we meet on those days, we are doing or taking any action that would in any way constitute a legislative day. And so that is the bill. It has moved through the Rules Committee in the Senate and would move to the Rules Committee in the House, as you've heard in the motion.
Through the bill, as amended. Representative Miller.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, so it's an inconvenience, apparently, to have to follow your rules, because essentially what you've just said is this would allow the House to meet in session and do a bunch of these motions where we move bills from one committee to another committee so we can essentially circumvent the deadlines, which we've had a problem with over the last couple of years because we've got so many committees and we're moving bills trying to make deadlines. Is that the inconvenience that you're talking about?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, that is the inconvenience is having to take up a legislative day, which you may need to count and carefully use towards the end of the legislative session to pass bills. And so you're having to constantly work backwards. And I think, so that's the inconvenience, but it's also an opportunity to make mistakes. And it doesn't matter who's in charge of the body. There's an opportunity to make mistakes when you have to count a legislative day each time you meet and try to work backwards and guess what you're going to need and have a budget of days and so on. So I don't really know that there's any purpose. I don't think it avoids the rules. I don't think it avoids the deadlines. I don't think it does any of those things. It just simply says that you can meet and you can take action, for example, electing the Board of Regents without burning up a legislative day. I mean, the purpose of limiting the number of days originally was to limit the amount of time the legislature meets in session. We're already limited by the Constitution, so defining a legislative day in that way is just a carryover. It's just a function that doesn't really serve a purpose.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, it does, though. If you can plan right now based on your 120 days, and I guess I'm sensitive about it because I think that the legislature really should go back to a biannual meeting. I think the move towards full-time legislators is a bad move, and I think this heads in that direction by loosening it up even more. So now you can meet and resurrect bills through, for let's say, the Rules Committee. You can pull bills out of different committees, put them in the Rules Committee after deadline, and resurrect them when they were done. It seems like that creates more work, and it does have a it smacks of potential abuse that you can get around deadline rules, which we really should be held fast to around here.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I don't think it actually would allow us to get by deadline rules. If we wanted to get by deadline rules, we could do that. we would just be using up potentially another legislative day that might be more usefully used at the end of the legislative session. There's always a way to get around that. But I agree with you entirely. I think the worst thing we could do as a state, almost, maybe there are worse things, but among the worst things we could do would be to put the legislature in session year-round and make it full-time. But this doesn't change that. The Constitution already limits the amount of time that we can spend in session. There's no statute that we can pass that would avoid that. All this does is make sure that when we are in session and processing bills, we're not being blocked by artificial limits on when we can actually go to the House floor versus sit in a committee room.
Yeah, and I'll be done, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Representative Winkler, you just made my point. You can't always get around the rules. This just makes it a little easier to do it by making sure that you don't have to burn another legislative day when you go to move bills from one committee to the other. And I don't think it's fair. I think you should plan within the number of legislative days that are provided, and you should have to plan accordingly. And this is not a good idea, but thanks for bringing it.
Representative Conn.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Emmer, you know, what you want to do is okay, except you'd have to change the Constitution to do it. So if you want to introduce the bill and take it to the vote of the people, you can do it. The one problem that I specifically want to go back to one-year session.
Oh, I thought. Okay. I just wanted to stop the
okay.
bill, Mr.
No, no.
Chair,
no, Mr. Chairman.
All right. But I can take it to the people.
Mr. Chairman, specifically, there was 1 year, and I could go back and tell you what year it is, but I don't remember it exactly. Where Roger Moe specifically use the Senate to cut off legislative days, to just meet all the time to cut down the legislative days. And I think that was an abuse of the process. The Senate sometimes does things with less deliberation than the House, and he wanted to take advantage of that and wanted to cut off the minority in the House. And so that the current law is subject to that kind of abuse of one body over another. So I think this is a sensible change that helps stop that abuse.
Representative Gutwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. See the bill as amended. Why are we removing first reading? Just out of curiosity, I noticed in the A1 amendment we moved from, in the original it says a bill of first, second, or third reading. In this one it says bill of second or third reading.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gutwell, you were maybe too busy thinking about James Bond, but we didn't adopt the A1 amendment.
We adopted the A2.
The A2, which A2 leaves the first reading in there.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It seems to me that, I understand the reason for thinking about this, but it seems to me that what we're doing here is enabling procrastination. You know, if we don't have to count days like yesterday, we can put off moving some things along to another day, and I don't think that's a good idea.
All right. Anyone wish to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, Representative Winkler, to your motion.
Mr. Chair, I would renew my motion that House File 1882 be recommended as amended be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Representative Rosenthal, there he is. I understand that House File 1820 is to go to the General Register. Representative Rosenthal, is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. I will move that House File 1820 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. 2 year bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This is an agency bill. It's pretty straightforward. It's extending an exemption from alcohol and controlled substance testing if it's already covered by federal statutes, specifically Title 49.
And Mr. Yolk, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kurt Yolkum of the Department of Finance. The state is currently covered by the Code of Federal Regulations, Chapter 49, Part 40, or Title 49, Part 40, requiring drug and alcohol testing for those who operate commercial motor vehicles requiring a commercial driver's license. In addition, the state is also covered by state-level drug and alcohol testing, testing laws, commonly referred to as DATWA. State law generally exempts political entities from DATWA requirements if it is compliant with federal regulation. And this proposal is to clarify that the state would now become one of the political entities exempt from Minnesota DATWA requirements because they are fully compliant with federal laws. There doesn't seem to be any evidence that when the statute was put into place that the state was excluded for any particular reason. This would not change any of Minnesota's, the State Department's drug testing policies or any of the employees' grievance procedures that they have should there be a dispute about the testing. This is just to clarify that since the state is compliant with federal regulations, that therefore, like other political subdivisions in the state, that would be exempt from Minnesota DATWA requirements.
Questions? Discussion to the bill? Anyone wish to testify for or against? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 1812 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails. Thank you,
Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Hansen, House File 424. Representative Hansen, I believe House File 424, I will move, be recommended to pass, and be re-referred to the Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House File 424 is a bill that has been amended going through the process, taking the executive order that Governor Klee signed in 1979, should be in your packet, and for your jurisdiction, it is saying that the DNR should develop rules, taking into account some of the things that are in the 1979 executive order. I think one of the significant changes that we made in...
I'm going to withdraw my motion, and I'm going to go to Representative Nelson. Representative Nelson, I believe you need a motion first before I can make mine.
I'd like to move the committee report.
Representative Nelson moves the division report. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Then I will move that House File 424... be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee. Sorry, Representative Hansen.
That's okay. I was just going to compliment Representative Nelson. And so in his committee, we did make some changes. And I think the key one to look at is the commissioner on line 4.2 and 4.3. The commissioner must take into account existing ordinances when developing the guidelines and standards under this section. We will provide for the funding for the rules out of the Clean Water Legacy Account. We just had an informational hearing in Representative Wagenius' committee downstairs. So we have the funding source. This does, the Mississippi River does serve as a drinking water source. So we provide for rulemaking and having it start. Mr. Shepard has looked over the language. There have been some changes to the rules throughout the process. With that, I would have any questions you may have.
All right, questions from members. Anyone wish to testify for or against the bill? Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Gregory Page. I'm Special Projects Director for the St. Paul Riverfront Corporation. Being passed out is a request from our Executive Director to have the committee consider laying over the bill so that the local units of government can work some more with the author and co-authors. We appreciate the work of Representative Hansen, co-authors and proponents of this bill. The work is ongoing. The amendment Representative Hansen just mentioned today we think is significant, making clear that local units of government have a significant role in this. Our goal is simply to make sure that this bill gives the DNR both the direction and the latitude to develop and adopt rules appropriate to the intent of the critical area, and significantly to allow and require local units of government to implement their zoning within those constructs. So we think great headway is being made. We just want to make sure that there will be the time to allow that dialogue.
Mr. Page, did you testify in division? In Representative Nelson's division local government?
Yes.
You did. And what local units of government are you referring to that
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The St. Paul Riverfront Corporation is a private nonprofit corporation. We work closely with the City of St. Paul, but understand other units of government within the entire critical area have...
No, I understand that, but you said you want other local units of government. Are they here today? Are they going to testify with you?
I'm not aware that they are, Mr. Chair.
This was heard in division, and it was passed. You testified there.
Yes, sir.
And there were amendments. And now it's before the full committee, and you're requesting us to lay it over because local units of government, which are not here today, want to work on the bill?
Yes, sir.
Representative Nelson, you want to fill us in on this?
Mr. Chair, the local units of government testified in committee. They had some concerns. Some of those were addressed. I think most of those were addressed by the amendment that was put on there dealing with not all superseding local ordinances. And I know they've expressed some concerns that they've had with it, but the bill passed in committee with the amendments that were put on.
All right. Representative Hansen, you want to comment?
The 2007 legislature required a report that the DNR completed, which local government units of government, industry, and public participated in. That report was presented to the legislature in January of 2008. In September of 2008, Senator Sieben and I convened an ad hoc work group, which the City of St. Paul was invited to, as well as the City of Minneapolis and others, to participate in taking these recommendations and reports into statute form.
Mr. Page, you've been here. You've already seen one bill laid over for obvious reasons. I would say that the division has done its work. People have been allowed to testify. They're not here today. So I will, unless anyone else wishes to testify. If you do, remember we have session at 10:30, so we have a couple other people suddenly who now wish to testify.
Thank you for the opportunity, Mr.
All right, thanks, Mr. Page. Welcome to the committee, and if you can be brief and to the point, since this was handled in division. Please identify yourself.
My name is Joan Olin. I'm the city administrator for the cities of Lilydale and Mendota. And I guess I agree with having this laid over. There's not been much communication to at least some of the smaller cities regarding this bill, and it affects us. Both cities are completely within the critical area. I was at the last conference or the last hearing, but I guess I would like to slide over so we can have time to look at it. Our attorneys can have time to look at it. We just haven't been that involved in this process. Thank you.
Could you repeat your last name?
O-L-I-N.
O-L-I-N. I've got a letter that was just passed out to us from the City of Mendota Heights thanking the representative.
I am Mendota, two different cities.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mendota being the oldest city in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you for the clarification. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities, have been working throughout the interim and throughout the legislative hearing process with the author on this bill. The primary concerns that the League has been raising at this time are in Subdivision 6 of the bill, which is the notification and fees section. There are two parts of it. One is that it designates a fine that would be charged against cities who fail to meet public notice requirements to the DNR. We have been saying that we don't believe that is something we can support. There's already a process that if the DNR does not feel that we've met the public notice requirement, they can actually challenge that the process was not properly done and ask the courts to remand the decision back to be done over again. We think that's a perfectly adequate way to deal with procedural problems with processing of a variance or conditional use permit.
Mr. Johnson, my motion is to send this to finance, and if the concern is the fee, that would be an issue for the finance committee. We do discuss financial issues here. I'm not saying that we don't, but primarily we're interested in the rulemaking and the setup of the council. So,
and
this is going to finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wanted to just point out where our concerns lie. The other subdivision B of that section is the other place we've been raising concerns, which bills local governments back for their cost of DNR staff time. On the rule proceeding,
another financial issue.
Yes,
which is a valid one. And
Mr. Chair, on the rule proceedings, we actually prefer seeing this done through rule writing over having it done in statute. We think it's a better process for determining detailed requirements for local land use planning. And we were actually one of the groups that encouraged the chair to take that route rather than try to take the executive order and put it in statute. To actually go through a rule process allows for scientific evidence, testimony, public comment, response to comment, the full administrative hearing process. We think that's a better way to do what could be a fairly detailed and challenging set of requirements for land use.
Representative Hansen, you want to respond to that?
We have worked very closely with the League of Cities throughout this process, and we continue to work with them, working on some of their concerns. So I appreciate the work that Mr. Johnson has done, and I too believe that the rulemaking provides a better process for having that public input and using the science that we have today with GIS, LIDAR mapping, the information that we can use for good land use planning.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify? One more individual, and please be brief. We have session coming up at 10:30. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Again, my name is Richard Townsend Anderson. I'm vice chair of a citizens committee of landowners immediately adjacent to the Mississippi, primarily located in Brooklyn Park. And I have two issues. Number one is I thank Representative Hansen for the encouragement of the commissioner of the DNR to consider local zoning. However, it is to consider rather than enforce local zoning. And the DNR, I come with I'll try to make this very brief, a short history. 10 years ago, the DNR recommended zoning changes to the city of Brooklyn Park that would have made my house and all of the other homes along the Mississippi non-conforming, which greatly would have affected our ability to sell, resell, you know, to develop or any of the rest of it. In intense negotiation with the city of Brooklyn Park, we were grandfathered in. Now, if the DNR comes back with the same recommendations in the form of rules, we're in real trouble. And there's no assurance in the bill as written that those rules will not be reimposed arbitrarily by the DNR. I would ask that there be included some method of appeal. There is no language about appeal of decisions for rules made by the Commission of the DNR. And also that there be greater force given to the very hardly won, you know, very difficultly won zoning ordinances presently in force. They help the local single-family dwelling owners to maintain and beautify their properties, and I'm afraid, or I fear, for the DNR being placed in charge.
Mr. Johnson, but there's nothing in the bill that would change the status of your home at this point. There's just a different process put in place. Is that correct?
I think you'd represent.
Well, Representative Hansen, why don't you respond to this?
Yeah. Well, this sets up rulemaking. We have the existing executive order that's in place today. It's 30 years old. And I think the key here is, again, on line 4.2 and 4.3, the commissioner must take into account existing ordinances when developing the guidelines and standards under this section.
I do appreciate that.
Yeah. All right. Yes. Further discussion? Anyone else wish to testify? Then I'll renew my motion that House File 424 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails. Representative Poppy.
Thank you.
I'd like to move the minutes of April 1st.
Representative Poppy moves the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails. Members, 8 a.m. Tuesday, and watch your emails because we've been known to start earlier if we need to. 8 a.m. Meeting adjourned.